Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and I'm having a conversation today with Mike P. Burton. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Listen, a couple of things that I want to do. The first thing that I want to do is to find out, what does the P stand for?
Patrick.
Patrick. Michael Patrick Burton. all right. We'll get into that later. But let's bifurcate the show and first of all, talk about what is going on in the world on the 4th of April, 2020, wherever you are, wherever your loved ones are, state of mind, state of being, what's going on. And then we'll be able to edit that all out after things settle down into that, and then we'll be talking about our show. So let's start there.
All right. I am in the house. We live out in Jersey. We moved out here a short time ago. And
yeah.
For this right now, for the virus and isolation and everything, it's perfect as opposed to being stuck in an apartment building with God knows how many other people, having to use an elevator,
right,
having to use a public laundry, all that. This is
yes,
perfect. We have the dog. We can put him out in the backyard. We can go in our own backyard. So I like that.
How wonderful. Aren't we, both of us, me here in Austin, Texas, and you in Jersey, wow. Boy, do we have it good.
It's a nice luxury to have, where you have your chest freezer and a backyard with a basketball goal and put the dog out there. My son can go play basketball, and we've had to create our own little world. You know, my son's spring break just started, and he's going to sit there and do what he's done for the past 3 weeks, except not have classes till noon online.
Yeah. That's amazing. What an extraordinary time. And so what is your own take on what's going on in the world? Are you writing about it? Is this going to be an anomaly? Is this going to be something that you're embracing or figuring out some way that you can do some good?
Right now, you try to write. It's not necessarily the funniest situation, but everybody's in the same situation. So when you do material, it's stuff that everyone can identify with. You're not going to run into anybody at any show once we're allowed to do shows again that won't know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
So
everybody's been in it.
Everybody's watching the shows. Everybody's going to know Tiger King, which is crazy, but it's – that's where we are.
It is. And it's a different world. So we're going to be coming out of this different than we went into it.
I think so. I mean, handshakes will be weird. Hugs will be weird. Any kind of group setting will be, as soon as you're in a group setting, the first person to cough, you're out. Get out of the house, get out of the club. And there's no coughing.
No, and there's going to be some ways of rebuilding that social trust. Are you wired as an introvert or an extrovert?
I'd have to say extrovert.
Me too. I gain energy. Like my wife will, the way she recharges is she goes and does a puzzle, and she's on the inside. I recharge by going to the store. It's nice that there are things that are there, but there are people there, and they're all herded close into a way that I can make eye contact and relate and nod and get some kind of investment.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. You have to have – there's got to be some kind of connection. We did a video happy hour. It wasn't on Zoom, but it was kind of like that, just a video call with friends of ours that still live in the city. And it was my wife and I on the couch, and they were on their couch, and we did it 3 hours. We've done it twice. It's been 3 hours both times, and we're both like, we should probably eat dinner. It's almost 9 o'clock. So also is that's the most we do. I mean, you make your phone calls.
Yep.
Hey, who haven't I talked to in 3 years? I should probably call them because I have time.
Yeah. Yeah. And we can make those connections and we can do that. How terrific. All right. Good. Let's make a segue here.
Okay.
And get into, here's what I want to, unless there's, is there anything else you want to say about this situation that I did not ask about?
I don't think so. I mean, it's, we're all in it together. That's pretty much where we are.
Ain't that the truth? All right. Well, let's make a segue here. Mike, your early influences in comedy, according to my research and my producer, Renee Jaworski, that we had, were Carlin and Murphy and Stephen Wright. You were how old and where were you when you were 18?
When I turned 18, I was...
Yeah, where?
I was in... I lived in Delaware. I went to high school in Delaware. I'm originally from North Carolina. We moved around a little bit, lived in Cincinnati for a little while. But senior in high school in Delaware, and then went back to North Carolina for college. But yeah, I mean, early on, got into Eddie Murphy. I remember his album, Eddie Murphy Comedian, where he has the rose in his hair or behind his ear, was the first album I ever bought. And then right after that, I believe it was Van Halen's 1984. But watched that or listened to that, I mean, countless times. And then Carlin's HBO specials, watched those, watched all the comedy that I could, loved it. I had a boombox and I would record Saturday Night Live and listen to it because we didn't have a VCR at the time.
Yeah.
And not until we got a VCR, and then I would watch those. And it was just, it was a good time. I mean, just good comedy. You look back now, even now, watch Eddie Murphy Delirious with my son, and it holds up.
Yeah.
All the jokes hold up. Aunt Bunny holds up. Everything, even him in the red leather, it all holds up, and it's all really funny. So I'm glad that was my influence. Stephen
God,
Wright
that's wonderful.
Was just different than everybody else at the time.
I agree. You know, to give you some contextual, all right, so today, in April the 4th, 2020, I'm 71 years old, about to turn 72. You are how old today?
50. 51 in May.
50. All right, good. So that just gives us some contextual as far as the arcs that we went through during that time. I got the button down the mind of Bob Newhart. That was my first influence. And that was when that was just knocked me out. And it was on an album. It was on a 33 and a third album. And I got a chance to be able to experience that. And loved it. You have to understand, I am the son of an incredible, she died in 1973. But people still talk about her as a great comedian and as an amazing performer. That had alcohol not taken her, and she'd been able to do, this woman was extraordinary. So I have like this Liza Minnelli complex about how can you stand up when you got this extraordinary light to be able to do. So I've had that to overcome. Did you have that influence to get to the stage? What was your route?
I was a theater major. Watching those guys, it was always, stand-up was something I always wanted to do. But at the time, I didn't know anyone doing it. I didn't know anyone in showbiz. How do you make a living doing that? And it just, I didn't know how to do it. So it just... It was always like a magic thing. Like, they just have specials. These guys are great. I didn't know how you start. I didn't know what an open mic was. I had no idea watching those guys back then. It was just something I was like, I would love to do that. I don't know how to do that. And so as a theater major, I went to school, went to college, theater major, moved up to New York, was waiting tables. I did a couple of plays, did a couple of tours and all that kind of stuff. And then it was one
day
where I finally woke up.
Stop. Hold on. Let me stop for a second. Your connection with the audience as a from drama and comedy in this, was that something that fueled you? Did you love it or like it, or was it just okay in a route?
No, I did. I liked that a lot. When I was in college, I actually started directing, and I enjoyed directing a lot too. I seemed to be better at that than I was acting in college. When I got out of college, I was acting. I was auditioning. I met my wife directing her roommate at the time in one of those showcase nights where agents come and all that kind of stuff. But
sure.
There was one day in New York, I'm waiting tables. I'm not doing any real shows. I haven't gone on an audition. I kind of said, you know what? Stop talking about stand up and actually get up and do it. And I got the backstage, and there was an open mic, Gladys's Comedy Room, pay $5, get 5 minutes. And I said, I have $5, let's do this. And the other ones, everything else seemed to be bringer shows, bring five people, bring eight people, get 5 minutes. And
yeah.
I didn't think I was going to be good. I wasn't that guy. I mean, you meet people all the time. Man, I knew I was going to be great. No, you didn't. Why did you? I've got hours of material. You have a journal. Sit down. But so I went up, and I didn't want to subject my friends to it. And how many times can you do that until you run out of friends? But I had $5. And so I went up, and I used maybe 3 minutes that first time. But when I walked off and I sat back down, I kind of went, yeah, I like this. Nobody threw anything. Nobody booed. I didn't die. I'll see you next Wednesday. And that's how I started. I kept doing it every Wednesday. Then you do more and more. You get up, but you still have to make money. So you still have to bartend at night and wait tables. And how do you find time to get to an open mic? So I finally made my schedule so I could get to a few. And all of a sudden you get passed at a couple of the clubs in the city. And so now you feel like you're a working comic, and you're working with great comics. You get passed at the comic strip. All of a sudden, you're standing there next to Greg Giraldo and Jim Norton and Dave Attell and all these guys, and you're like, oh, my God, like everybody you've ever seen, and you are going on stage with them. And then all of a sudden, somebody takes you on the road, and then you start contacting bookers. And back then, it was VHS tapes. Everybody had the 10-minute VHS tape that you sent out to everybody. And somebody would use you, and others you'd never hear from again. And so you'd start making money little by little. And then I got into colleges and had a college agent and started making money, real money, to where it was all I had to do. And so I went full time in 2000.
How
and
wonderful.
And been doing it ever since.
All right. Now let's go back to those first times when you're doing, what were you writing about? And what was the writing process, your own thinking process as you're doing? Because when I do comedy, I am not an observational comic. I'm much more of, I am the crazy person in a sane, trying to look at the world and interacting with it. You know, I'm flummoxed by cleavage. Cleavage throws me off my game. So that's me interacting with the world as opposed to standing outside of the world and commenting on the craziness of them.
So talk
to me about your process and what you're so I can understand it from a writer to writer level.
When I first started, I was lucky enough to where when you're hanging out with everybody, whether you're standing around the keg or you're just standing around the table and everybody talking, everybody has stories and stuff. And you have your go-to stories. Oh, this is my party story. I got this. And so I had a few of those, and that's all I could start with. I didn't have a real set. I just had what I thought would work and had worked in the past at parties. And luckily enough, it worked. And those jokes were general enough for people to understand. A lot of times when you see a new comic, they'll do, my aunt does this. Well, nobody knows your aunt. And those stories kill it at every family reunion because everybody knows aunt Alice or whoever it is.
Absolutely.
The reason everything works at work is because everybody knows Earl, and Earl is hilarious. Whatever that is, where you think you're the funniest man in the room, and you are in that situation. But stand up, people learn really quick, oh, nobody knows these guys. That's right. Now sit back down. So I was lucky enough to where those stories work. And my comedy, it's everything's based on something that really happened. And then it's embellished, and there's punchlines, hopefully, and laughs throughout to get to the hopefully the punch at the end.
Yeah.
I can't. I'm not that guy who can just sit there and I'm going to write for 8 hours. I can't do that. If something happens, I know pretty quick this can go in the act, and I just have to figure out where to put it and how to make it funny and where the punchline is.
Exactly.
And it's that part is hard. I wish I could. I wish I was that guy who could write all those jokes that Buddy Hackett did that are great street jokes. And but somebody wrote those. People are like, no, that's hack. Everybody, but somebody originally had to write that. And I wish that I had that, but I don't.
I understand that, but each one of us has the process. I don't know how that is, because I've done a lot of reading and a lot of listening to comics and the process and how that, and it's got to be an individual way. I know the one thing that is dangerous for me in this whole process is comparisons. The instant I get into a comparison mode, my creativity goes to zero.
Are you comparing yourself to another comic?
Exactly. Me to another comic, me to whatever. I have to stay into what is special and precious and amazing about my experience and stay true to that. Because the minute I don't, and I get out of that. This is one of the things that impresses me about you, because you have taken Let's Talk About Race. And I grew up in the Jim Crow South as a white, male, privileged human being. I mean, I saw and white water fountains. I went to movie theaters that had a separate entrance and a balcony that said colored on it. I saw a bus station that had white and colored waiting rooms. So I go through that, even though I grew up in, I know, this is so weird. You ride the Continental Trailways bus in an integrated bus, but then when you get off the bus, there's separate waiting rooms. Blew my mind.
Wow. And yeah, I've never seen that.
I thought I was this liberal because Wanda was this theater person, and so I was very introduced to many of her friends who were gay, and we were very much into the liberal consciousness. So I didn't know that I had all this white unconscious and conscious biases that I'm just carrying around, but just because I'm a white male privileged, so I'm thinking about that. Now, what's your story?
So I also grew up down south, but we never talked about it. It was never a them and us. I don't remember that ever being a thing. My friends were my friends. One of my very first friends in kindergarten was Sean Coleman. And I don't know why I remember his name. There's nobody else from really that time that I do. But when I moved from Charlotte, I remember calling him, and he was like my first best friend, and he was black, but it never came up. I remember my mom loves a story that when I was in second grade, she got a call from my second grade teacher, and the teacher was very upset that my girlfriend in second grade was a little black girl. And my mom was like, well, they're in second grade. I don't know that they're going to get married. And even if they did, let's leave it alone right now.
Wow.
the teacher was offended, whatever. So, yes.
That is wonderful. So, but did you have an awareness that we had privileges?
I didn't. Just never occurred to me. It wasn't. It was never brought up. You just kind of, you did what you did. There was no, yeah, I can do this and they can't, or I deserve this. That never came up. It was never a thought. I don't even know that I heard the term white privilege until like the last 20 years, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't remember growing up like, you've got white privilege. What? I didn't know what that meant. I had parents that said no, and the spoiled kids, that is probably what would have occurred to me. That's white privilege. Look at that. Sure. I'm an only child, but I'm not spoiled. I don't get everything I want. You know, and that's the only way I would have thought about it. Now I'm like, oh, yeah, I get it. And you see it, and it's awful, and you can't explain it away. There's no. It's weird. Like that old story of you don't correct old people when they say colored, and you don't do this. Well, they grew up
exactly
like that. And so white privilege, kind of the same thing, where I can't explain it to you that's what you're doing right now, but get out of line. You go to the back of the line because you're last. There's no get out of here. I don't have any patience for that. I'm not very good in those situations at all.
How did you begin to bring that into your comedy? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Keep talking what you're doing, but then segue into that.
As far as comedy goes, I try to not be afraid to say anything, because as far as when I do the I can get whiter bit, and going living in Washington Heights, which is very Dominican, very Puerto Rican, and we hang out. And it was hilarious. I mean, you're outside, you're talking to everybody, and it's just friends talking. It's comics like that. When you hang out at a club with comics, there's nothing better than that. Nobody, because you're not afraid to say anything in that situation, because no one's going to get offended.
Right.
As far as standing around with comics. And the same thing when you're standing around with your friend, and everyone's just friends. This is not my black friend. This is not my Puerto Rican friend. These are my friends. We're hanging out talking like anybody would, about sports, about whatever, music, about whatever it is. Yeah, I don't know anything because I'm white. I don't know any music you're talking about. Okay. That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can't be afraid of it. And why would I be afraid if I don't have any problem with anything to begin with?
Yeah. Exactly.
I lash back, or I don't know what you call it, but I do get people online in the comments that see that some things that I say, but it's all people who I think that they should be offended.
Right. Right.
Does that make sense?
Do you know a line? I mean, do you know when you're getting close to a line? Like, I've worked out some material about how I believe that you need to, that the way that we get economic recovery is to parachute in married pairs of male gay men into disadvantaged areas and give them property, because I see every single place that this would be a U.S. government. Because every place I see where male gay men are and congregate and begin to spread, the area gets wonderful. It gets beautiful. It ends up everywhere. And I even have a name for it. It's called HomeraCore. Now, that's a straight white male doing that joke. But I did go to the gay and lesbian Toastmasters and did the joke there. I pre-screened it and to be able to do, but that's close to the line. That's walking up to the line.
Right.
And
it did well. I'm guessing that it did well.
Yes, it did. It did very well. They thought it was hilarious.
And you'll take it to a club somewhere and it won't do as well And there will be people that will come up to you and be offended, again, because they think they should be.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
And that's,
do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I do. I do indeed. I mean, that's part of our umbrage. You know,
right.
Am I
but
going
I
to
love
take
those
umbrage?
Jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. And me too.
That's a great joke.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I
it's
do.
Part of
I like the take
the,
on it. I like all of it.
It is, and please, I'm offering to you as a fellow comedian that please feel free to, if there is something that comes out of this and you please, and you feel like that you'd like to use it or you'd like to riff on it or to do anything, please go ahead and do it. See, and just let me know. Let me know. I love the idea of open source. To me, open source is the way to go. Austin Kleon, who is one of my favorite writers, says, you know, he wrote the book Steal Like an Artist. And, you know, let's make sure and see what is a way that we can riff. So with what you're doing, one of the things when I was talking to my producer about you, doing this show with you, Renee and I were talking about how you engage with the audience so much. Wow, that's not something I've ever been either done or been able to do. Could you talk about that process, how that developed, and what are the challenges, the opportunities, and the work that you're doing there?
Kind of became its own animal, I guess. I mean, I never wanted to be or thought about, like, I'll be a crowd work comic. But I do like playing with the audience and being, if I'm playing with the audience, it's to go into a bit. If we're talking mm-hmm. about kids, if we're talking about marriage, if we're talking about where you live, whatever that is, travel, then I'm trying to get to a bit. And then there's times where you're getting there, but then it kind of goes off the rails of the intention, and that's where the fun begins.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to get confident with it and not be scared of an audience. You can't, again, you have to, you know, stand up is all confident.
Oh God. Isn't
no
it?
Matter what your persona is, it's all, I'm very confident in what I can do, with this audience.
Yeah.
But
and that's,
I do.
And all right. So the first few times you did it, I mean, here's my experience. Is that I'll have a lot of success with something, then there'll be this curve downward where I'll have to learn, like I did it like almost like a savant, like it happens, then I go, oh God, I don't know how that happened, but I want to do that again. And then there's this low part that it takes a while to redevelop it until I find out what it was I actually did, and then to build it up. Did you have that experience or something like it?
Yes. Of course. I mean, you have the one where it's the happy accident. Oh my God, did you see that? I was a genius. What did I do? And then you think, you have to know that you can't force it to happen. When you see crowd work comics, where you're from, what do you do? Where you're from, what do you do? It's the same thing all the time. The first time you see it, like, this guy's a genius. Watch this. But there's always a cop. There's always a construction worker. There's always a teacher. There's always a nurse, doctor, whatever that is. It's going to be really rare to have that job that you haven't heard before if they've been doing it long enough. But you can't rely on that. So you get an audience that doesn't want to play, and it's weird. Like a whole audience that's like, no, we just want you to talk. Okay, that's fine too. We can do that. But you better have something to back it up. And crowd work comics, you want them go through the audience, and they found the four people that want to play, nobody else does, and then they go back to those four. So where are you from again? Still Seattle. The whole audience is like, he does construction, we get it, move on. But for me, I do. I know where I'm going to go, and if it goes off the rails, that's fine, and I can go back to where we were, where my original point was going to be, or we just leave it alone. If it was that great, there's times where it goes, I mean, you've been where it goes so well. You're like, oh, my joke's not going to follow this. Let's just move on.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like a great happy accident where it just, everything sets itself up. It's a little comedy gift. And in your head, you're going, oh, this is wonderful. I'm never going to write anything this funny. Let's just keep going.
Oh, and that is a magic. And I know there is something I have over the course of my life. I've not used needles because I'm afraid of them, but I've explored a lot of drugs over the course of my life at different kinds of consciousness expanding. But I have never had a high. I have never had a high like that great comedy laugh when an audience is with you and it happens. There is nothing like it. There is just that communication, that sense where they're with you and that you're with them and you're taking them somewhere. It's just extraordinary. I have a hard time. I mean, you've been doing it so much more than I because I'm much more I'm a communications coach, and so I'm working on that. So I'm doing the Grandma Moses thing as far as getting back into performing. but that high, that opportunity to be able to be there with an audience and have it happening.
Right. I think the only thing that could come close would be probably in sports where you just won your championship and your fans are there and everyone is with you on every single play and there's no higher feeling. You finish. But for us, you get that. That audience is with you on the way out. Yes. Oh, man, that was the greatest thing. We go to a lot of comedy. This was the best. Right. Until next week. I get it. But for that night, for that moment, you have it. And you're only as good as your last show. But
always,
you can do that if you have like a five-show weekend, one Thursday, two Friday, two Saturday. And you have one of those weekends, just a magical weekend where that Sunday going home, whether you're driving, flying, whatever it is, you're just sitting there going, I did something this week. And it was beautiful. And it's definitely a humbling thing, but it's a very powerful, that was me. They loved what I wrote. They loved what I said. It's a very personal thing, which when people bomb, it's a very personal thing. Same thing. And the opposite of where you're going. I'm just going to sit in a corner and cry for a little while. You don't mind, do you?
Yeah. It's an amazing feeling to do an entire set to nothing. To complete. I mean, to sit there and to know, to have that voice in my head going, this is going to make a great story.
And everybody's bombed.
Nothing. And to have that experience as we have it, and it was worthwhile. It was worthwhile to do that because if I survived it, that 4-minute set on that one particular open mic, okay, that we can I can go through that. Now, all right. Now, help me to understand. All right. So if you 20 years ago that you began and you were able to support yourself as a comedian 20 years ago and then up until today, tell me the difference in the comedy or the subject or the perspective of 20 year ago, Mike P. Burton, and 10 year ago, Mike P. Burton, and Mike P. Burton today. Give me that arc of what's happening. Of course, not of course anything, Dennis. Please give me that.
All right. Wow. So 20 years ago, the material was, I'll say, simpler as far as I was doing a lot of colleges. And so you write what you know. You write dating. You write going to the gym. You write roommates are like this. It was pretty simple. It got laughs. And every comic has to, we're like, man, I'm not proud of those jokes at all, but it got me started. And then got married, got a kid. So then your writing goes that direction. And I stopped doing colleges, not only because everybody seemed to be PC, which is absolutely true and all that, but I stopped writing for colleges. I didn't have any Kardashian references. I didn't have any pop culture, right, which seemed to be a huge thing that came in. I didn't have all those references. I did this thing where I wrote jokes and had punchlines. And he's like, if you didn't read this book, you're not very smart. I didn't have that. But it was writing about kids, writing about now going from girlfriend, going to wife and living with a wife and all of that material. And I got to a point at colleges where I had to try to work all of that in and try to bring them along. So it is, I'm married, but you guys are dating, you know what it's like. And I have a little kid. Well, you guys have little brothers and sisters, you know what it's like. And I got sick of that pandering.
Got it.
I kind of went, I'm out. I'm good. I'll do one every now and then, but very rarely. And even then the whole time I'm like, it's just a check. It's just a check. I'll take the check. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But, I love doing clubs. If you could make great money doing clubs, everybody would do it. Started doing cruises and worked with some great comics on cruises. It doesn't have the stigma that it used to, at least I hope.
Yep.
And I don't think it does. That it used to
I don't think it does at all.
Well, they started putting real comedy clubs on there. Mm-hmm. And so people went there for actual comedy and not just, you can't land the plane with the seat back. Yeah, we all know that. Since 1977, stop doing that joke. Won't they make the whole plane out of the black box? Shut up. I can't do it. And so I got into the cruises and it just kind of, it works out. You know, I don't mind the travel. Some guys hate the travel. Of course, there's bad hotels, there's bad condos, and a whole comedy life that looks glamorous and couldn't be more opposite when you show up to a condo where you're like, oh, my God, what's going on in here? But it's probably the greatest job, and it's the only thing I can do.
Exactly. Exactly. And you're all, and all right. So now that was 10 years ago. So you're 40 then.
Yeah.
And so are you watching, you're watching your material change. You're watching the culture change at the same time, because we can't lift ourselves out of the culture. Things that would have been, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg sitting down and talking about abortion, her support of abortion and the right of reproductive justice in front of right there in her confirmation hearing and then be confirmed 97-3 could not happen today. Just contextual. And so the same thing is happening to you and happening to me in the material as we're growing, as you're seeing it having to juggle the culture and what's going on as it's moving. So talk about that.
Like we were talking about earlier, I mean, when you go to race is a big thing.
Yeah.
Race is everywhere
God,
now, is brought up all the time, 24/7. I don't do political comedy at all. I've never, I don't think I've written one political joke, but it's because there's guys that do it really well, and I leave it to them. That's not the way I think, and I know immediately, as soon as you say anything, you're dividing your audience. Why would I do that? I want everybody. I'm here for everybody. I'm not here, hey, if you're on that side, you're wrong. I can't.
Right.
I don't get into that at all.
Unless you're Mort Saul. I mean, Mort Saul or somebody that could actually just do this in their own way, right? I mean, but that's some pretty rarefied air.
Right. Well, there's guys that I miss. Like, I miss Geraldo and I miss Carlin because you want to know what their take on everything that's going on would be.
God, yes.
I want to know what those jokes are. And I can hear them in my head, but that's not the same. And I'm like, oh, come on. But I do. I miss that. But again, Jon Stewart did it great. I thought he was phenomenal. Yeah. There's just a lot of Jimmy Tingle out of Boston does a lot of politics and political stuff, and they do it great. And their spin on it, their take on it, that's fine. Yeah. But there's a lot of guys that try to do it who they don't have a joke. It's just an "Are you with me?" And then that gets an applause break, and they think it's a joke, and I promise it's not.
It's not.
If you think, we're going to be great. Ugh.
Yeah. So what's your take on currently? What are the things that you're currently? Because again, I love that you're talking about race, because race is something that is under talked about so deeply in our society. As I look out at it. The Supreme Court decision, the 5-4 decision that took away took all the teeth out of the Voting Rights Act, because according to the Justice Roberts, racism is over. Well, and then I say, well, if it is, the racial makeup of the Congress? Does it reflect our society? Look at it's been proven that whites and people of other races commit crimes at approximately the same percentages. Let's look at our prisons. Do they reflect? How is that? Let's look at our economics. Let's just look at the economics out there. Does it reflect? Does our general society economically reflect it distributionally? And it doesn't. So this issue is not talked about, but you get a chance to be able to bring it in.
I bring it in a little bit. I don't do the economics and all that. That's for comics that are really smart. I'm not reading. It's one of those things. It's out there, and you bring it up and you talk about it, and hopefully there's a laugh there that we can all jump on, whatever that is. Right now, everybody's going to have their virus jokes. As soon as this is over, everyone is going to have their stuff. And I don't know that shy away from it. You can't get by without having a couple of lines about it.
Absolutely.
It's kind of like I never wrote a Viagra Cialis joke, because I knew as soon as it happened, everybody would have it.
Right.
And I was like, I'm going to leave that one alone. Let everybody else do it. And everybody did. You would go to a comedy club, and every comic up there would have his 3 minutes on Viagra.
Right. Yeah.
Have we not heard enough of this one? Okay, good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it is so. How has I guess a couple of things that I'm that, so where do you, where are you looking? Where is the leading edge of rough draft material? How does it work with you, Mike? When you're right now in your own personal writer's room. Do you have collaborators that you ping thing off of? Do you have material that is in early stages of development that come in? Take me inside your writer's room.
I have friends that we call each other, and what do you think of this one? Is there something there? What do you think about this? Have you heard anybody do anything like this? That's a big one too. You don't want to take something. And you're doing it and you think you wrote it, but somebody already has it, so it's done. You can't do that. So we do, and I do enjoy that, calling my friends and bouncing ideas off of them. And then with comics, you can sit around and everybody has a different line, and there's one you're like, yes, that one. And they just help you out. You have to have that kind of camaraderie with people.
Yeah.
Right now, I'm trying. Most of my stuff is in the same vein as my cell phone bit. People that talk way too loud on their cell phones, or they're just rude on their cell phones. Because I think right now, as a society, it's a me first society. And yeah, I'm bothering you, but I get to because I'm on my phone and I can't stand it. I didn't grow up with that. It was, if you were on the phone, then go away from people. Nobody wants to hear that. But we also didn't have cell phones. You went in another room. You didn't just sit out in the living room with your parents as they were watching TV and be on your phone to your friends. You went wherever that phone was. Some people had that long cord, and you I'm going to go in the bathroom and talk to my friends, because you just didn't you didn't want them to hear you, but you also, they didn't want you to be around them. And people don't have that now. You have that freedom. You can be on your phone in the grocery store, at doctor's office, like wherever that is, and it's just everyone's me first. I can't stand the people that can't take their carts back at a grocery store. Those things that are irritating, that I think irritate most people, but I also want people that do that to come to a show, and the next time they're on their phone, like, oh yeah, the guy said, yes, he did. Yeah. Now get off your phone. You know, take your cart back. If you could shop for 3 hours in a grocery store, you can walk it the 20 feet back to the cart return. Just take it back. I don't have to turn into a parking spot and your bag or your basket is there. I can't stand that. I make my son get out of the car all the time. Hey, man, can you go move that? Yes, finally.
How old is your son?
He's a teen. He's a teen. He's learning to drive.
How did he deal with being hit with that flush of testosterone that goes in? The testosterone is a tough drug. I mean, it is a really tough drug to be introducing into a brain. And when that just floods in there, wow.
He's good. We're lucky. He's a good kid. There's times where it is I guess every kid at that age, at the high school age, where you try to explain, hey man, all these situations I've been in, I can help you get through whatever situation you're in. I promise. We've all had this trouble. We've all had trouble with school. We've all not liked it. Nobody knows why we're taking algebra. We just are. Just deal with it. Everybody had to do it. Everybody's had girl troubles. I'm telling you exactly how this situation is going to end up if you do this. And he'll come back and be like, yeah, you were right. You're like, all right, can you just believe me first next time? Nope.
Nope.
There's no way that's going to happen. Why would I believe you last time? This is a fluke that you knew this situation.
And it's been a fluke the last 40 times it's happened.
Every single time. Every single time. My friends are going to do this. Well, this is what's going to happen. And then it does. Yeah, it did happen. Huh. I can't believe it. I can't believe it happened exactly like I said, because I went through it. I had friends too. I promise I was your age at one point. But I did the same thing. I probably didn't listen, and I could have. But I didn't think my parents knew anything, and they were geniuses.
I know. And it's the wonderful, that's the wonderful cycle. And that's one of the things that I love about being 71, is that I actually get a chance to experience what old age is about. What are the elders of our tribe, and experience something. When my death is much actuarially closer than I can, that, I mean, it's actually there. I mean, I see the doorway. I see that. And so it really gives me an opportunity to live life much richer, or at least to address the reasons why I was wanting to avoid that. And you're getting a chance to have your son go into high school and get into, see the maturity of your relationship with your wife, and the maturity is where you're going at 50. And what does that look like? What does 50 look like to you? And that is bringing awarenesses to you right now.
I feel much younger at 50 than what I thought 50 was like when I was his age.
Exactly.
Does that make sense? Like, it's
God, it,
like,
does,
I remember
it, it
thinking,
does.
50, you were a grandparent at 50. You were old. You were retired. What is 50? My God, how do we, don't you just sit around all day and talk to other old people at 50? And now I'm like, wait a minute, I can do everything. Look at that. Go shoot baskets. I'm active.
Exactly. And that's what I love about my age, Mike, is that while my battery life I cannot do those 21 hour days or have that length of time, the quality of the time that I do is richer than anything I've ever experienced. I'm having more fun. I'm doing better work. My attitude is better. I have more of a beginner's mind at 71, almost 72 now, than I had 10 years ago. Okay, I'm getting that fresh. This is really exciting because that was not in the publicity.
right.
That was not how
but you're
it was
also
sold. It was not so. As a matter of fact, when I was a kid, they tried to sell me adulthood. Oh, you wait till you're an adult. You'll see that it's no fun. You're going to work hard as hell, and you're going to have to work. You're going to have to give up all these things. What kind of a sales pitch is that? How do you expect a kid to buy into that? Why was I still into my teens when I was in my 40s?
Right. Yeah. I also feel like I'm younger. I'm a younger 50 than a lot of 50-year-olds.
Yeah.
And you seem like you're younger 71 than I can even picture anyone 71.
Exactly.
Like, I'm sure when you go out, like when I do shows and they're like, yeah, I'm 50. I'm like, seriously? I would have said 65, but all right, you be 50. All right.
And that, what I love about that is that chronological age and the age of our consciousness or our personality, how fresh we, those two things are disconnected for me right now. I mean, there are certain things that still come through. I mean, but in general, I've really tried to decouple those two things.
Yes. I think also, and I've talked about this with friends of mine, I think as comics, we stay younger longer. There's very few comics that I know that actually look their age. And I think a lot of it has to do with the job. And there's stress with the job, but not like people with real jobs have.
Yeah.
There's not, I don't have a boss yelling at me. I don't have deadlines necessarily. I'm lucky enough to where I kind of get to pick and choose when and where I work, which right now is nowhere. I'm choosing this. But I think the comics that I know, and we're all around the same age, came up at the same time for the most part.
Right.
They just always seem younger than people their age.
Sure. Well, I think there may be something in the creative process. Because if I'm constantly having to create and make new and go into myself and to work on that, I think that has a rejuvenating aspect to our body and our consciousness when we do that.
Yes. Yeah. It can't not help you with having to have new stuff because you're not stagnant and just working on I got a new jigsaw puzzle. All right.
That doesn't count at all. We've got about 5 minutes left. You've been so gracious to give me the full hour today. What have we not talked about that you would like to talk about today, or that's on your mind or on your heart?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have. I didn't really think of that. I think right now. I mean, everyone's waiting. You just want to work again. This is the only job where. Really looking forward to going back to work. And most people, it's because of money and bills and all that, which absolutely makes sense. And I get that. And I have that too, but I want to be in front of an audience again. I want to go out and do shows. The last two shows that I did, They were great, great audiences. And thank God, like if I had bombed on that last show, and then you have to live with that.
Yeah.
And somebody did. There's got to be comics out there who bombed on that last night before they said no more shows.
Oh, yeah.
But luckily, the shows went well. But it's a job. I really do. I love this job. I tell people all the time, people, it's hard to explain to people that this is a job that you want to do. It's the only job where you go on vacation and you're like, yeah, but I could probably get up somewhere. There's nobody else doing that. There's not a plumber who's like, yeah, there's probably going to have somebody with a problem when we go that I could do.
Yeah.
There's no doctors like, well, somebody will get sick. I'll get to work a little bit. I don't know that anybody has that, but I know as comics, you go to whatever town it is. You know, like, I'll bet they have a room or a club. I could probably get up one night. We're gone for a week. I can probably get out on Tuesday and do a couple of minutes somewhere. And I don't know that anybody else has that, but I do. I miss that. That's where the thoughts are right now. Like when can we get back to normal, but when can we just get back to work? I just let's go. You know, I'm
absolutely.
We've had a 3-day or a 3-week vacation. It's like you ever meet somebody from Australia and like, yeah, we're on holiday. Like, oh, how long? 4 months. What? How'd you do that? But it feels like that's what we're doing now.
That's we'll find out. Mike, thank you so much for this time today. Thank you for letting me into your mind and your consciousness and where you're going. I have other things that I would have loved. Fortunately, I had a whole list of ideas of different things we could pitch, and we got about 2 into them. And because I deeply appreciate that. And so if there's a time when on the other side of this and what you've learned and what you've learned about yourself and we can connect again, I would like to do that.
I'd love it. Anytime. It was a lot of fun. Nice to meet you. Great talking to you.
All right. Thank you, Mike Burton. And we look forward to talking with you again. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks.